Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 7th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Lust, the craving for salt of a person who is dying of thirst. Studying 2 Samuel chapter 11 verses 1 through 26, session 4 of the 7 Deadly Sins. A Bible study in week 2 now, presented by Brad Binow, number BIB 2003-09. Let's listen in.
Now, and I teach pastoral theology at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. But for last week and this week, I'm doing the Bible study leadership here at Holden around the theme of the seven deadly sins. So whether you've been here or are just dropping in, welcome to a conversation about your spiritual state and where we are in conjunction with that. Today, we will look at the deadly sin of gluttony. Just very quickly, where we have been, to put a little bit of this in context, some definitions we've been working with. We've been trying to think of sin in light of the village theme of for the healing of the world, and recognizing that sin is that theological category from which the world most needs to be healed. We've tried to keep sin in focus in two ways at the same time, always as a large overarching description of our fallenness and who we are, that condition that we are in bondage to and from which we cannot free ourselves. At the same time, as we say in the confession, at least in the Lutheran Book of Worship, that we are sinning through various thoughts, words, and deeds. So while we are all caught in this general condition of sin, we also commit specific sinful acts, or sometimes we've omit doing certain things, and those end up being sinful acts as well. And that those two are always in tension. Because we are anxious about our sin, recognizing the fact that we can't really do anything ourselves to change our spiritual condition, or at least at times we think we can't, we still try to. And when we recognize the desperateness of our situation, that's when we fall into sin. So it's our anxiety that drives us to commit sins in lots of ways. We are in the poet Edgar Lee Masters in his Spoon River anthology has a great description of the human predicament. He says, "We are like chickens with angels' brains, able to see the axe before it falls." and that is that's as good a description of our sinful predicament as I can think of. We know that we're doomed, but unlike the rest of creation, we know that we're doomed. We can see the axe before it falls. And in desperate attempts to avoid the inevitable, we commit our various sin. And therefore, we're involved in what we've called here culpable shalom breaking. Sin is the disruption of God's pattern of shalom and wholeness for the world. That's out of a book that's in the bookstore called Not the Way It's Supposed to Be by a Reformed theologian, Cornelius Plantinga. And indeed, sin is not the way it's supposed to be. Theologian Ted Peters has said that sin is very unbecoming, and he means that in both senses. It's not attractive, but it also is the uncreating, the unbecoming of humankind. And what God is about is trying to restore our sense of being, of becoming, of creation, and whatnot, in the light of all this problem. I mentioned this, I forget when I mentioned this the other day, but I know some of you are new and didn't have a chance, and I don't want anybody to miss out on this great opportunity. A woman in my wife's congregation, my wife is a Presbyterian pastor, so a lot of the time I'm worshiping with the Presbyterians. And I did a short unit on the seven deadly sins there last year, and a woman sent me this out of a catalog. I'm not sure the name of this catalog. But you know, one of those things that show up unsolicited in your mailbox. And she was embarrassed that this had come to her, but she said, "I couldn't help but share this with you." You can now get the Seven Cardinal Sins plaques by artist Joseph Lester. I don't know who that is, but anyway. It says, "Pick your favorite sin." And I got pictures up here that you can order. It says, "In morality plays of the late Middle Ages, the seven chief human vices were portrayed by actors. Now, artist Joseph Lester exclusively for Design Tuscano, maybe that's the name of this, I guess. They got an 800 number here. Has brought these seven outrageous characters to life in a series of plaques sure to tickle your funny bone. Can't keep your head out of the fridge? Hang Gluttony in a conspicuous spot nearby as a reminder to shed a few pounds. Parents of Teenagers, The Gift of Sloth as a wall hanging in a loser's room is worth hours of nagging. Think twice, though, before giving lust to anyone you don't know very, very well. And anyway, now here's the deal. Each cardinal sin is $24.95, but you can get a set of three for $49.95, and you get the whole set. Buy five, get two free here for $125. Only in America can you buy five and get two free.
That's the best deal in sin, though, isn't it?
Huh?
You want to get the best deal, you get them all.
Well, absolutely. And so they've got them listed A through G here, and an appropriate sort of order number for each one. And you call this 800 number to, but anyway. This is so ridiculous that
I
had to
think about.
Huh?
Do they talk about greed, or is that the price?
No, that's in here. No, it's listed as the next to the last one. They don't have them in the same order that we're quite following them, but well, it's funny. This is exactly the sort of utter trivialization of the deadly sins that we have to try to recover from. The idea of hanging that on your refrigerator to keep you from gluttony, I hope by the end of the day we'll see that that's probably not the best tack of the day. Funny, but whatever. Maybe we have to laugh about these things, because when we get right down to it, they are deadly, they are serious, and there's enough room for some holy hilarity around all of this as well. But anyway, you know, save your money. I've been tempted. I've thought about getting those and hanging them in the classroom. I teach this course periodically at the seminary. I thought that might be kind of interesting. They're actually rather good. The facial expressions are more or less accurate. Anyway, enough of that. We're going to get into gluttony here. Well, two other things as we get going. I've said before, in the medieval church, the seven deadly sins were assigned one for each day of the week, sort of as a way to help people remember what they were, and in a pre-literate society, every sort of help in concentration like this was useful. And so things started with pride, assigned for Sunday, because that was almost universally held to be the most deadly sin, one that would pull you out of your relationship with God and excessively into yourself, so it was best combated by going to corporate worship on Sunday, participating in the Eucharist, and so forth. Out of that flowed anger and envy, and then in the middle of the week, on Wednesday, was sloth, and the sin of hump day, when you were too far between, you're right in the middle of worship experiences, likely to lose your focus and not care about anything. That led to greed on Thursday, and then gluttony, which we're picking up today, was focused on Friday. I think that had something to do with why Friday became a fast day, or at least a meatless day, in church life. And then lust was considered the most deadly sin of the body, and that was saved for Saturday, when you had been farthest away from your previous week's worship experience and needed to be especially concentrating and focused and preparing yourself for worship experience the following day. And we'll be talking about lust tomorrow, but you'll have to wait for that. I couldn't get all these things to line up on the right days of the week, given how we were teaching them here at home. So think of this maybe sort of like Friday, even though it's Wednesday. Point. In each case, I've tried to suggest that the deadly sins, maybe in some ways, are misnamed. They're not so much deadly sins in and of themselves. They are dispositions which can potentially become deadly dispositions. There are particular sinful activities that flow out of each one of these. In each case, then, there's a potential positive, healthy side to all of the deadly sins, or what I want to call an upside. And so we'll start with that. I've tried to suggest what that might be in each case. So what's the upside where gluttony is involved? Well, I think it has a twofold focus here. While gluttony is certainly not all about food, I'm going to talk mostly about our eating habits here today. Eating should be for the purpose of taking in nutrition. And so in that sense, that one of the upsides of how we eat is it should facilitate our personal growth. I mean, keeping our bodies healthy and so forth. Whatever it is that we put into our mouths should help us grow, or I would say at least not do us any harm. There may be some, you know, sort of neutral things that we eat. They're not all that great for you, but I mean, iceberg lettuce is one of those things. It's got the nutritional value of cardboard or something. Someone's told me, but it doesn't hurt you. I mean, it's better than Cheetos or whatever. It should, I mean, whatever we ingest should be useful to. I mean, I'll leave a little bit of room in here for moderate alcohol consumption. although now more and more we're hearing that that's actually good for you. A glass of Merlot a day keeps your cholesterol rate down or whatever. I was delighted to find that out.
It was a very poorly constructed study.
Oh, darn.
Okay, well,
it would seem that in moderation, you know, a slight amount of alcohol is probably not going to do you great harm. And as I've said before, the whole point with most of these issues is all things in moderation. Accept moderation, and in that be excessive. So try to find the middle way. So one of the positive aspects here is of physical, nutritional growth, and so forth. But there's another aspect of eating, which is a communal aspect. Eating together, the breaking of bread, should be a way to enhance community, a way to facilitate not only personal nutritional growth, but also spiritual growth in terms of koinonia, growth of community. So these, I would say, are the two good elements of ingestion or eating: personal growth and spiritual communal growth. How we do our eating ought to serve those ends as best it can. So in part what I'm saying, I guess, is that eating is about more than just the elimination of physical hunger. Our physical hunger is in some ways an indication of our need for nutrients, but truth be told, our physical hunger does not need to be completely eliminated at every meal. I mean, you just have to sort of get past the critical point where, I mean, so that you're able to function, you have enough nutrition in your body and so forth. And certainly, it serves no purpose to eat past the point of the elimination of our hunger. Although we've all done that, right? It just feels good to keep eating. on the other hand then, while eating with others in a community setting can facilitate spiritual growth, food in and of itself cannot satisfy our spiritual hunger. But part of what's going on is we see when we eat past the point of satisfying physical hunger, we're often looking to fill ourselves with something, with some kind of sensation that doesn't have anything to do with physical nutrition and so forth. This is the title that I gave. This comes from Frederick Buechner's definition that gluttony is raiding the icebox for a cure for spiritual malnutrition. And so we're looking for the wrong thing to serve this need we have. I want to get on here in a minute and talk about a little more deeply gluttony as a deadly sin, but let me just pause there and see how this strikes you. Do those two potentially helpful, healthy aspects of this make sense? Mm-hmm. Or can you think of others? Maybe I'm always looking for more ways to enhance all this. Other upsides to the way we eat and drink? It's great when I've said it all.
The situation, you know, certain animals, they will eat to excess because the next day they're not sure they're going to have a meal.
Right. They may know they're not going to have a meal, and winter's coming, you got to, you build up all this excess. I say good for them, and they're probably wiser in what they're doing than we are. I mean, what are we doing, bulking up?
But in this culture, maybe not, but what about other cultures?
Right. There are cultures, I think I could name a few, where it is common that people will have a huge feast and then may not eat again for 3-4 days. That's kind of how I always feel when I eat Chinese food. You know? The problem is in 3-4 days you're going to be hungry again. There's always so much on the table. But, in some sense, but that's not a very long time. I mean, humans don't have the capacity to store up like, I don't know, bears and chipmunks and squirrels may do. And I think the key difference there is we have some awareness of the future that I think I can say that the animal world doesn't quite have. This is the chickens with angel brains thing. They do it out of instinct and are in some ways cared for and provided for by that instinct. We are called in some ways to curb our instincts where they start to go bad on us. And so maybe there is some kind of animal, less than fully human, inherited, evolved impulse in us that wants to do that. But we have at least partly angels' brains that help us see the bigger picture and ought to know how deleterious that can be. And so I think that's an instinct that we may have to check. I've really sort of confined most of my comments here to North American culture because it's the only culture I really know well enough to say anything about. Yeah?
I think you mentioned communal meals. Somewhere I think family dinners and family meals are even something different than sort of a communal meal.
Right. Well, I guess I would include that in what I'm trying to suggest as communal. I mean, there's communal and then there's smaller communal, but still it's relational as opposed to just eating all by myself.
And the other thing is you know, this is kind of garden season when the tomatoes come out of the garden.
Right.
I think there's something in the, and when you sit down and have a meal, that's something you've helped grow that kind of touches a part of your connection with the world.
Yeah, when you're closer to it, or getting to eat a fish that was just in old lake yesterday. I mean, it's all brought so close. We're out of touch with some of the meaning of our eating because we're so far removed from the production of the food. And if we really knew how a lot of the stuff gets on our plate, it might make us cringe. I mean, I think I'm happily ignorant about some of that.
You brought it up now. It's the economic footprint of what we eat and the choices that we make in nutrition. That's another theme, too, where we have some intentionality that we can bring to.
And here there's probably some overlap between what we were talking about yesterday with greed and now we're into with gluttony. And these two sins go together in many ways, although one of the things we pointed out yesterday is that gluttony at least has a physical limit to it. You can only ingest to a certain point, then you pass out or you die. Greed, where's the limit? You know, you can keep taking in. And so, one of the issues with how we're choosing to raise food and feed ourselves is that greed drives that. We don't often even see that economic footprint till way down the road when it could possibly even be too late. Let me develop here a little bit.
What about the concept of a feast as a good thing in and of itself?
Right.
In moderation, of course, as an occasional thing. After Lent.
Well, what about?
I think that it's a as part of a cycle. You know, if you have done without for a long time. Or even not for a long time, or the idea of coming back from Holden and having a steak, rather than just a continual sameness, cycle.
Sure. I mean, it's absolutely clear that the Bible is in favor of periodic feasting. I mean, and it's just there. One of the really unfortunate things is that we have the luxury in this culture of feasting so much and so often that it's almost impossible to preserve the real nature of what feasting is about. On Friday, we're going to talk about how all this may come together in Dickens' Christmas Carol and the story of the life of Ebenezer Scrooge. And one of the things we'll see there, I think Dickens is wonderfully evocative with his images of food. And it works because he's already painted the picture of how desperate and meager the Cratchit family lives 364 days of the year. And so even their meager little Christmas feast becomes a real event when, against that sort of backdrop, you know, you can't eat to excess every day and then expect feast day to suddenly become something great. It's just going to happen. So, in some ways, our lack of moderation has robbed us of what could have been one of the great gifts of appreciating what real feasting is about.
Are you going to address food as pleasure? You have up there spiritual malnutrition, right. But I don't see that necessarily as being enjoying a meal for right. The flavors is not necessarily a sign of spiritual malnutrition.
Right.
So.
I was, but let's just do it now. there is a sense in which when we're involved in gluttony, one of the things that we're sort of walking right past is the savoriness of food, its texture, its taste, the pleasantness of it for its own sake. Now that's different, I would say, from treating food as kind of comfort food. You know, I may like the taste of Oreos, for instance. There's an addictive quality to the sugar and whatnot in that. But if here we're just talking about the gamey taste of venison or the texture of raw vegetables and that sort of thing, right? I think that is entirely pleasurable and good and wholesome, and not only does that serve nutritional needs, I think the ability to eat communally, though, and share conversation about that is even better than just, you know, me eating it all by myself. But I would say all that is true, and then one of the unfortunate downsides of gluttony is that's not one of the reasons that I'm eating. I'm trying to fill myself in a way that sort of moves right past all of that pleasantness just to get to the end sensation. And in that sense, then I'm not even that concerned about what I'm eating as just being filled. And that's the sad part. Does that make sense? Okay, well, so where does it all start to go bad in terms of the deadly sin? Again, I'm going to talk primarily about food here, but I think this could be said pretty much about anything we ingest, be it any kind of substance, alcohol, whatever. I'd suggest a book to you by a woman, a theologian, Mary Louise Bringle, rhymes with Pringle. her book is entitled The God of Thinness, Gluttony and Other Weighty Matters. And she herself has struggled with an eating addiction and an eating disorder, and pretty frank about that. And I'll share some material here from her book, but it raises many good, significant questions that we ought to contemplate. One of the authors I've read on the seven deadly sins has pointed out that for most modern people, most modern North American people, eating has no great particular meaning. In many ways, it's lost its significance. It's sad but true. Now, one of the ways when I'm teaching at the seminary, I can get people to check this out, but it doesn't really work here at Holden, so you have to transplant this back down the valley. But is just to think about sometime, can you remember from the previous day what you ate and when you ate it? That's not so hard to do here because meals are regularized and everything's listed right there on the whiteboard of the dining hall, and you can probably remember. But on many days, I can't quite remember, what did I eat for breakfast? Did I eat anything at coffee break? When did I eat lunch? It all kind of goes past me, and I don't savor each moment and enjoy that. It has no particular great meaning. I've been in places in the world, Holden is one of them, that have helped me get in touch with eating in a more intentional, meaningful fashion. Being in Tanzania, where I've been the last couple of summers, doing some work for the seminary, eating communally, eating in the guest house there, eating lower on the food chain and more simply. Times that I've visited Russia, and I'll say something about that in the sermon tonight. This is a great place where you don't have to try to get people to come hear your sermon. Anyway, I'm preaching tonight. That's right. At a Lutheran seminary where I visited there in Russia, they eat communally, they eat more simply. All those things have been meaningful eating experiences for me. And I'm always amazed that when I get home, I have such trouble remembering and replicating and continuing the good patterns that have been part of life elsewhere for me. Maybe you don't struggle with that, but that, you know, it's not always been the easiest thing for me. Well, so one of the things we're talking about is our eating becomes gluttonous when we're eating or drinking more for the sake of pleasure and comfort than for nutrition and community. And in fact, Donald Capps, one of the authors I've been mentioning, his book Deadly Sins and Saving Virtues, sees gluttony primarily as a sin against companionship and community. That when we're being gluttonous, we're more interested in, you know, meeting our own needs, taking care of our own hunger, than sharing the experience with others while we eat, kind of against the notion of real feasting. One doesn't imagine a biblical feast in the sense of me feasting all by myself. That's always me and everybody kind of in it together with plenty to share. And in fact, in extreme gluttonous cases, as Mary Louise Bringle has pointed out, the glutton literally does not want to be seen eating and must do one's eating or binging privately. And that then we're at the level of really talking about an eating, kind of an eating disorder.
Maybe only West Coast people see the Carl's Jr.'s advertisements, but they're amazing in encouraging gluttony. They show somebody eating a huge hamburger, and the tagline is, "Don't bother me, I'm eating."
Yeah. That's it.
So
that's
it's a lot of food, and I want to be all by myself. Yeah. And someone thinks this works. I guess it does.
I like Carl's Jr. I'm just saying they have to advertise it. In fact, one of my Ohio relatives is related to the person who started it. Way back in the 40s, or whatever that was. But right, we can now sell stuff to people with the saddest of rationale behind it, and that would be one, I think. Mary Louise Bringle points out that gluttons may be the only persons who find it easy to love their enemies. And so there you sit, you know, consuming what you know in a sense is harming you, but you love it all, and you're encouraged to love it. This is ironic, this sort of approach to eating, because, quote Diogenes Allen, professor at Princeton Seminary, in his book Spiritual Theology, he says, if we can't control our appetites, it's unlikely that we can ever be strong enough to give up anything for the sake of another person or do something for the sake of another when it runs counter to our appetites. I think, as I mentioned the other day, this is the whole notion behind a Jewish sense of keeping kosher, at least as one rabbi explained it at one point to me. He said, you know, Jewish folks at this point simply believe that what chance do I have to keep the Ten Commandments in all the serious things that those are all about if I can't do something simple like regulate my eating habits? I'm just practicing on the little things before I get to the big ultimate things. That's worth contemplating. Am I really going to be able to be spiritually available for others if I can't curb in some way something like my physical appetite? There are plenty of exceptions to that, I know, but there's some correlation worth thinking about. Back to Mary Louise Bringle for a second. She really asks an important question in pointing out that we pay very little theological attention to gluttony. You know, we laugh about it, and ridiculous little things like this and so forth, but as a real theological issue, the culture is fascinated with diet stuff, dieting, diet books, all that, but theologically, the church has not really tried to think its way into the deeper meanings of gluttony. And so she asked, do we really consider personal diet too trivial to warrant sustained theological exploration? Might we not appropriately, even urgently, concern ourselves with what she calls the psychotheology of everyday life? That's pretty interesting. I mean, something as common and everyday as eating. Have we really thought our way into theologically what all that means? Especially in light of the fact the Bible's full of food imagery and eating and so forth, and also conversation about fasting. We'll get to that in a minute. Well, Mary Louise Bringle again, pointing out why it may be hard for us to engage this. This is a really interesting quote. She says, discussing masturbatory practices and sexual preferences would be easier and more socially acceptable for some than discussing fantasies and fetishes having to do with food. And she's saying that out of her own reality as someone who struggled with an eating disorder. She'd met plenty of people who had a real issue and deal with food. That's worth thinking about. And so gluttony, in a sense, becomes a kind of slow form of suicide. We know that, in a sense. I mean, you can eat yourself to ill health, and as we talked about a few days ago when we looked at that parable of the rich man and Lazarus, one of the ironies of that parable is here's poor Lazarus starving from lack of food and nutrition, while the rich man, and I mean, Lazarus is dying because of this. The rich man, on the other hand, is probably dying because of overconsumption. Who knows what kind of fatty diet he's taking in there, probably clogging up his arteries and eventually dies of a heart attack. I mean, one gets that sense of he's feasting sumptuously while Lazarus is starving from malnutrition. What an imbalance. So, of course, if we just begin to think globally, I mean, one of the horrendous sinful parts of gluttony is we overconsume while much of the world has not enough to consume. And I'm preaching to the choir here at Holden if we go too far with that. Well, back to why gluttony is sinful here. Gluttony's not only sinful, not simply sinful because it's excessive and intemperate. That's certainly part of it. But if that were all there were to it, then we just get ourselves on a good diet and cut back, and that would wipe this out as a deadly sin. Again, Mary Louise Bringle says, you can't heal an obsession by replacing it with a counter-obsession. So if you become obsessive about diets and so forth, that the obsessive quality is still there. I think people that I've talked to who've been involved in recovery movement, AA and so forth, say, ultimately it doesn't work to replace my obsession with alcohol with another kind of obsession. That may start me down a better path, but ultimately I have to find a way to be filled and to have my spirit, deeper spiritual needs met without becoming obsessive about that. So I think what I'm trying to suggest is gluttony is sinful, when we get right down to it, because of the ways that it keeps us from dealing with our real emptiness, which is our spiritual emptiness. If the intake of food is a misdirected approach to create a kind of fullness in myself so I don't have to be aware of my emptiness, my hunger, and so forth. And we'll say more about that in a second. So again, according to Buechner, the glutton is one who raids the icebox looking for a cure, not for physical malnutrition, but for spiritual malnutrition. And now we're into something more theological where Mary Louise Bringle is trying to get us to go, I think. Gluttony represents this misbegotten attempt to fill spiritual needs with physical, tangible resources. We turn to the things that we can consume and take in as a substitute for the things we really need to bring us peace and fulfillment, things that finally are of a spiritual nature and come only from God. This is Bible study, so let's get to the biblical text here for today. You'll recognize that this text that today is almost an exact parallel of what we used yesterday, although from a different gospel and comes in a different context. Matthew chapter 6 verses 25 through 33, and if somebody wants to get a finger on that so we can read it, I'll just add one verse to it. One chapter previously in the Sermon on the Mount, in chapter 5 of Matthew, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." Hungering and thirsting used in a spiritual way to describe our longings. But then Jesus goes on in chapter 6, at least in Matthew's recounting, to talk about some of these issues. Yesterday, when we talked about greed, we read much the same passage, although in Luke's gospel, it's located in conjunction with someone coming to ask Jesus for help in dividing the family inheritance, and then Jesus tells the parable about the rich fool, and this section of scripture is used, speak to the question of greed. Here, it more stands alone, so I'm lifting it up to help us focus on the gluttony issue. Somebody have it, Matthew 6, 25? Any volunteers?
I can
read
it.
Do it.
All the way to what?
To verse 33.
Okay. Look at the birds of the air, but they do not sow, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single cubit to his lifespan? And why are you anxious about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that even Solomon, in all his glory, did not clothe himself like one of these. But if God so arrays the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more do so for you, O people of little faith? Do not be anxious then, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or with what shall we clothe ourselves? For if these things the Gentiles eagerly seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first God's kingdom and God's righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you.
Thank you. Well, there are certainly other passages we could seize on in the Bible that more specifically condemn gluttony. Proverbs 23, there is the parable of the rich man and Lazarus that I already mentioned. Jesus, at various points, is accused of being a glutton simply because he's enjoying food in the feasting in the company of others. But I think that the passages that can most help us at least focus what I'm trying to focus on here in the spiritual nature of this are those that help us understand why eating without a purpose is not helpful. And these are passages that focus us on God as the appropriate object of our hunger and the real source of our contentment and fullness. And so in this kind of passage, we're asked to identify more clearly what our real, deeper spiritual needs are and to understand that God is ultimately the source of filling those. Here Jesus is saying that if the birds and the flowers are full of the glory of God, certainly God will fill us. So, I think in the Beatitude, in the short verse I read there from Matthew 5, Jesus is suggesting that it's a blessed thing to be in touch with the deeper meanings of these desires for fullness, contentment, so forth. In the Matthew 6 passage that we just read, then there I think Jesus is pointing to the fact that it's out of our anxiety, we talked about here a minute ago, our anxiety about the future that we tend to want to overreach and make things happen for ourselves and not be as trusting of God's providence as we are called to be. And that, now I think we're down to some of the really deep level of what's sinful about gluttony, and it's highlighted here in the anxiety factor in this passage. Back to Mary Louise Bringle for a second. She says, two basically sinful things about gluttony. It represents a lack of trust. When we're in our gluttonous moment, it seems to be saying we don't trust that this same pleasure will be available to me in the future, so I have to get as much of it right now as I can. We gluttons are people who want to bring as much of the future into the present moment as we can stomach, so to speak. And another side to this, then, she says, is gluttony represents the fact that I simply don't know what to do next with my time. I don't trust that there is something to do that's equally as meaningful as eating. And how often have we all just, you know, in a leisure moment, reached in the cupboard and grabbed a bag of this, that, or the other and sat down in front of the TV to pass some time? Well, you know, I'm going to get puritanical about this, but we got to ask ourselves, what is going on there? What need am I meeting when I'm eating in that fashion? Well, that'll bring us right up to a comment I want to make here about Erickson in terms of trust versus mistrust. But before we get to that, let's pause. Either out of this biblical passage or what we've been saying here about gluttony as a deadly sin, what thoughts does this raise up for you, or questions you might have, comments you want to share? Yeah.
You glossed over the responsibility that I think that bothers me a little bit. The part of gluttony that we do today is, in my opinion, is letting everybody else worry about what happens to the animals that we eat.
Yeah.
And not thinking about that as that's okay. I mean, to me, that's part of gluttony. Jesus put the animals in our care. There are some people that when they're eating it, not that you necessarily have to be a vegan or a vegetarian, but of course that's the end product of that, I think. But one can eat the meal and give thanks for the life of the animal that
right.
has been slaughtered and right. take responsibility for how that animal is treated. If, like you started to say,
right.
If we only knew the way
right.
those animals
right.
are treated, and maybe you don't go into this area, but to me, that's part of gluttony is total, you know, animals in our care,
yeah.
and we, most of
well,
us have no idea what's happening to them.
And like I say, probably most of the time I should be grateful that I don't know.
But isn't that a cop? You know,
no, it is in a sense. I mean, if I really knew, would I be able to eat the same way? I think I only have this disagreement with you. I do agree this is a terribly important issue. I'm not so sure that this is most directly related to the deadly sin of gluttony. I think it is probably more related to greed in that sense. It is true. We raise animals for consumption in some of the most awful and desperate situations, which, I mean, it's a factory kind of operation. And that is not out of any sense of reverence for God's creation or even always the health of what we're consuming. And we're kept happily ignorant about what's going on in all those cattle pens and chicken coops and hog farms and so forth. My basic inclination, though, is to say there's an economic motive behind that probably lines up more carefully with greed than because I can be gluttonous even with the best prepared,
yeah.
most carefully prepared stuff. You know,
yeah.
That's not necessarily an issue of how it comes to me. But I don't take any dispute with you that there's an issue there. I think that is an important issue. And I'm sorry I didn't think to get into it more yesterday when we were talking about greed. It may also have something to do with lust, actually, now that I think about it. So we'll come back tomorrow. I mean, in terms of our inordinate desire to take in and so forth.
Or sloth.
But,
or sloth.
Huh? Or sloth, yeah, exactly. Our happy, casual indifference and not wanting to pay attention. Yeah, sorry.
That actually is what I was going to say about food. That I think part of gluttony is when we don't even think about, are we hungry? What are we hungry for? Are we full? We don't appreciate the meal. We just kind of consume it.
Right.
We don't eat too much because it tastes good. We eat too much because we're not paying attention
yeah.
to those, you know, feelings at all. We just
yeah.
And maybe that relates very closely to spirituality. That,
right.
you know, we can go through life not thinking about what we're hungry for, or what we're receiving our fullness.
Yeah, and when we talked about sloth the other day, we said that sloth is not mere laziness, but it's this sort of apathy or indifference. We just don't recognize, we don't care. Actually, the more I think about it, that may tie even more directly than greed. We just can't rouse ourselves to have enough passion to get involved. Yeah.
This thing that you're talking about is this whole vast array of emotional eating that is an issue with a lot of people. It's interesting to me to hear, it's like I've never, you know, it's like challenging my spirituality to say that it's like to reduce all the aspects of emotional eating into spirituality issues. I mean, it's like, I don't know. Is that saying that the ultimate hunger is spirituality and I'm not willing to say that? Or what?
Well, I think Jesus is saying there's a deeper hunger than mere physical hunger. And that's the hungering and thirsting for ripeness, righteousness, right relationship with God, and right relationship with all of creation. That deep longing and desire to see shalom restored. And that our physical sense of hunger or thirst ought to serve us to help get connected with that deeper spiritual longing. I don't know if I want to make any more out of it than that necessarily, but I think there is a connection. Yeah.
The sentence, do we live to eat or eat to live,
right, yeah,
sort of condenses the thought.
There you go. That's mm-hmm. That may be the short mm-hmm. short version.
But isn't it?
Let's go here first.
I'm going to change the subject. Oh. I don't know that one. I was just going to the passage that she read, and my sister and I have talked about one of the best things about Holden is not having to worry about preparing the meal, knowing what to have. And so it makes it a lot easier to have that community at the meal and not to worry. And if I take that back home, maybe I need to make things more simple at home so that it's a simpler thing.
Right.
Go out to eat.
Yeah.
I think too in the United States we're gluttons for dieting, and we lose, you know, I mean there are people who are starving themselves.
Yeah.
When I was living in the New York area, there were kids who weren't getting enough fat in their diet. You know, having brain trouble. So it seems that's a big part of gluttony too. You know, just being obsessed with not eating and not, you know, and nothing will taste good. And the feeling of being hungry is what you're after. So there's that.
But this is a part of Mary Louise Brindle's book, The God of Thinness, the worship of the sort of the other side of this. And again, I would say it's keeping the focus then merely on the physical and not allowing that sensation of hunger to transcend to something deeper and gets at a more spiritual concern.
I think too, what people don't realize is some of this, I think, is just habit. And also we're kind of beholden to marketing. Our society, there's been a lot of, I don't know if people have heard all the bad things about obesity that's coming out in the news now, but the average size of a hamburger that you get in fast food now is twice the size as it was when I was a kid, for example, like the first Big Mac hamburger. And so we're apathetic, we're just taking this and eating it and not even realizing that it's twice as much as what we really need. And so I don't know how you get around that, I guess raising your awareness.
Well, and one of the things we said yesterday, when you look at an advertisement, you know, the first thing you ought to ask is, what am I being sold? Second thing you ask is, what's the product? But the first question is, what are they selling me? Well, they're selling me some feeling or sensation of something. And then we have to ask, is that good for me? And a lot of times, of course it isn't. Yeah.
Is hoarding related to gluttony, or is that greed?
Greed.
Greed.
Next question. No. I mean, they obviously overlap, and that's where these are probably, I think, the two most closely linked deadly sins. There's certainly some overlap. Classically, I think we've talked about miserliness as being more connected to a derivative of greed.
Okay.
Okay, I want to entertain everybody's thoughts. I do hope to get a thought in here about Erickson and Virtue.
The word hoarding came to mind, and then you were talking about trust and trying to bring everything from the future into the now and stuff like that, which made me think of retirement funds and how we grab stuff in the future to save it for...
Hold that thought, because I want to come back to the future thing in a second here.
Even on this issue that on obesity, it seems like it's endemic throughout the society. You go to restaurants and stuff like that, that all the portions have gotten bigger.
Yeah.
So is our society as a whole kind of getting more gluttonous?
I don't know, been at a snack bar here lately?
Ice cream bar?
Holden Scoops.
This may be impolitic, but I'm going to say it. What's going on in the snack bar at Holden is not a good thing. We don't need that much ice cream. You know, 5 scoops is just too much. I'm serious. That is not modeling for our kids what we need to be modeling. And it's not in keeping with the rest of the philosophy in the village. We kind of asked that question. And I'm out of here on Saturday. So.
I would like to hear you talk about combating gluttony with hope. I'm just hoping there's...
Okay, all right, let's... we'll get that in just a second. Okay, two more comments and we'll...
One more comment. It's not just eating out. Joy the Cooking Cookbook, the original edition.
Yeah, right.
Most of the meals were served 6 people. Ah. The same recipe now only serves 4.
Okay, right.
I just got back from France. Wonderful food, much smaller portions.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was great.
Yes. But I've eaten there.
I was wondering if the opposite of gluttony, I think of the Eucharistic meal.
Right.
Of everyone eating together, but everyone having enough.
Right.
It's a really powerful symbol for me every Sunday.
Well, let's see if we can't get to the theological here and bring the hopeful aspect of that in. Two things. I've tried in each case here with Deadly Sins to suggest, as Donald Kapp does, that at the various 8 stages of Erickson's theory about human development, as we struggle with one particular issue, we may be developing an inclination or a disposition to one of these particularly deadly sins. And Kapp suggests, it's a little odd, but entertain it, that the very first stage of life, trust versus mistrust, is where we have to get some things straight, else we fall prey to a gluttonous disposition. And because hope is the virtue that Erickson suggests needs to come out of that stage, that's how these things get linked. Just a thought on that. That very early, you know, in the early years of life in the crib and so forth, infants are having to learn to rely on the big people around them to supply their needs. And to trust that something will be there in the future to meet those needs. To trust that the nourishment will come when I'm hungry. There is sometimes a tendency for infants to want to nurse and so forth longer than they need to. We need to help with love and care, give infants the understanding that they are taken care of. We also need to develop a healthy sense of mistrust. You want more trust than mistrust, but you need a little bit of mistrust to develop, else you become indiscriminate in life. You can't trust excessively that anything you put into your mouth will nourish you. You have to, part of this early stage of learning in life is learning a sense of appropriateness, what works and what doesn't work. So you need to be able to discriminate between milk and, you know, Drano. You need to know the difference between a pacifier and a pencil, or something like that, so that some things are trustworthy and other things should not be trusted. You know, in adult life, you need to discriminate between, you know, milk and champagne, between carrots and cookies and so forth. You can't indiscriminately take everything in and make it work for you in the same way. In some ways, gluttons are folks who falsely trust or excessively trust that I can take this into my body and it won't hurt me. Well, you know, there's only so much fatty stuff and whatnot you can take in before it absolutely will hurt you. And so learning this appropriate balance of trust and mistrust is important from early on. I don't know, we could say more about that, but let me just move on to the virtue here, that hope, classically in the ancient church, that the notions of sobriety or temperance, abstinence, those were the virtues that were usually promulgated to combat one's gluttony. But as Caps has pointed out, those don't really get out of, they're just behavioral adjustments, and what we're looking for here is a way to kind of adjust attitudinally to where we are. That's where hope comes in. Erickson has the classic, for me, definition of hope. He says, hope is the enduring belief in the attainability of fervent wishes, in spite of the dark urges and rages which mark the beginning of existence. That's almost poetic. That's a lot to soak in. But the enduring belief in the attainability of fervent wishes, despite all the things that you're up against in life. And so, to be hopeless is actually a great support for gluttony. And hopelessness is finally what gluttony feeds upon. And in that sense, what greater calling can we have than to be people who instill hope in the world? That's one of the great contributions we can make for the healing of the world. This is a matter of saying, I don't need to bring all of the future into the present moment. I have a sense of hopefulness that God will be there to provide in my future moments for me. And if I'm sensing that I'm hungry, then that's a longing to have God provide on God's plan in God's time and not have me try to take control of that process. One of the questions, of course, that has to be asked, how does one become hopeful when you're not feeling hopeful? Well, only by the grace of God, I suppose. But as we also said the other day, when one embraces, one is also touched. There's a point at which we reach out to be around hopeful people, to put ourselves in hopeful situations, and let hope then come to us. At least having the longing to be hopeful when we're not feeling hopeful. That's part of this hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Let me just add one more thought here. If you want to practice this somehow, a spiritual exercise is the practice of fasting. Tomorrow is Hunger Awareness Day in the village, so maybe this is a good day to think about fasting. It seems to me lately in church and society, we've practiced fasting often as a way to, you know, take the money that we save and give it to a World Hunger Concern, and I'm all for that, and that's great, and that's part of what happens here at Holden. I want to suggest there's yet another reason to fast, which is to get in touch with this spiritual sense of emptiness. The notion is that if I intentionally choose for a day to experience hunger, that physical sensation of emptiness can be the cause for me, every time I sense that, to ask the spiritual theological question of, what do I want God to fill me with? You know, and I mean, it's not just peanut butter and jelly. It's, I need something deeper. My physical sensation can be the springboard to a greater spiritual awareness. So, you know, this may or may not be for you. This is not legalism or anything. You might want to think about this. Maybe say tonight you just don't eat dinner. I mean, drink something. Don't ever skip fluids and so forth. But skip at least one meal. Maybe you skip dinner and breakfast and pick it up with lunch tomorrow. And watch what. Oh, maybe come here tomorrow hungry and see what that does for you. If you haven't done that in a while, maybe this would be a moment to do that. St. Augustine said, when people are hungry, they stretch out towards something, and while they're stretching, they are enlarged. And while they are enlarged, they become capacious, that was his word. That means able to contain a great deal, to be capacious.
And when they have become capacious enough, they will be filled in due time. That's part of what the practice of fasting can do for us, is help us experience that emptiness and let it expand and know that in due time God will feel that. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, says Jesus. They will be satisfied, and in a way that physical food will never quite fully be able to do for us. Okay, well, the hour speeds by. Apologies for every comment that wanted to be added in that we didn't get to. But thanks so much for your participation, and hope to see you back tomorrow.